I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Washington is scrambling to assess the political fallout from this weekend's leak of thousands of pages of military intelligence. Afghan expert Andrew Exum writes in today's New York Times that the documents don't tell us anything we didn't already know about the war and will only further confuse a complex conflict, something Massachusetts Senator John Kerry echoed in opening remarks of his Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing on Afghanistan this morning.
I think it's important not to overhype or get excessively excited about the meaning of those documents. For all of us, the release of any classified information, I think this needs to be stated, is unacceptable.
But when the documents first came out, Kerry said they raise serious questions about the reality of America's policy towards Pakistan and Afghanistan. And by the way, he's the guy trying to get foreign aid to both countries, while Congress is preparing to vote on a war funding bill the end of this week. Let's take a look at the issue with Gail Shattuck. She's congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, what do you make of John Kerry's statements? When the documents first come out, he said they raise questions about strategy. Today he says we shouldn't take them seriously.
I think he, of all members of Congress, must have been stunned by the revelations, not just to insiders who had talked about this for quite a while, but to the American public, that Pakistan may be double dealing, working with the Taliban as well as with us. Because Kerry was the architect of the notion that you infill Pakistan with U.S. aid. He pushed for a $7.5 billion development aid package. And so I think his initial response must have been, I'm in serious trouble here. This policy is in serious trouble here.
But Gail, we have to jump in and just ask, is that possible? Because here on this program, we've talked about concerns that Pakistan intelligence was working with the Taliban and the thinking that the U.S. would just sort of have to work around that. It seemed to be, as Andrew Exum writes, knowledge.
But not everybody is hearing this. I mean, it really is striking. I've even spoken with members of Congress. I quoted one of them, Congressman Pence, who's the head of the Republican conference in the House and one of the leading House conservatives. He told a group of reporters yesterday that he had never heard any of this in the briefings he'd been through. Other members have also said that, you know, our briefings don't fit with what these documents reveal. So I think part of the calculation Senator Kerry is making is, how is this going to play outside? Is Congress going to rise up in moral outrage at what Pakistan is doing? Or will it slide along as it has to date, that this is a kind of realpolitik? Pakistan has very difficult choices to make, and we're going to try to get them to make some that are in our interest as well. If this is out in the public, it's a whole other matter. And that, I think Congress is listening for that, as much as responding to it as individual members.
Well, but I have to ask you, Gail, is Congressman Pence being honest? Is it possible that he hadn't heard about this in briefings?
I never underestimate what it is possible for members of Congress to pick up out of briefings. You know, you can have 12 people in a room think back at Speaker Pelosi's discussion about whether she was aware of torture. You had a number of people also in those briefings that came out with entirely different views about what was said.
So at any rate, what you're saying is that lawmakers are understanding that at least some of the American people who may not have heard this are now hearing it, and they have to rush to cover their bases. What do you think this means for the upcoming war funding vote?
I think it's fascinating. The war funding bill has cleared the House with a lot of extra spending. For example, $10 billion to help teachers avoid layoffs. That spending was critical to get some of the Democrats to vote for it. It moved to the Senate. The Senate stripped out all of that extra spending, didn't even win a majority. With Democrats in the majority, now it's back in the House in a week when these papers come out first thing. So it's very volatile at this moment. I was interested to see Speaker Pelosi note yesterday that none of these documents go beyond December 2009. That is, they don't cover this new strategy that the president has embarked on of disengagement as of July 2011. But if you listen to today's hearing, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, there's a lot of discussion as to what that deadline actually means. Does it mean we will decisively pull out, or does it mean that we will calibrate based on the factors on the ground. And all of these questions are going to come up as the House takes up this issue this week.
Well, and Kerry's hearing today was also about whether to support a change in strategy in, you know, conducting outright reconciliation or peace talks with Taliban leaders. How do these papers impact that?
Well, I think they speak very strongly to the issue of how much can we trust, how reliable is Pakistan as an ally, and how effective is the Karzai government. That's another theme that came out of this the hearings today.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, before it was knocked off the radar by those leaked documents, race was on the front pages and the front burners. There was the smearing of Shirley Sherrod, the African-American Agriculture Department official, accused by a blogger of racist remarks. It turned out this daughter of the Jim Crow South, whose father was killed by a white farmer who was never prosecuted, actually spoke of overcoming a bias against whites to help save a white-owned farm. The administration apologized for firing her and has offered her a better job. Then there's the former Bush Justice Department lawyer who says the Obama Justice Department, under Eric Holder, is only interested in protecting minorities. This because Holder's department scaled down a 2008 case in which three new Black Panthers were accused of intimidating voters. Now, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights is going to issue a report on that case in September. But one member, Abigail Thernstrom, a conservative Bush appointee, has already said she thinks the whole brouhaha is small potatoes, that the Panthers were in a majority Black district in Philadelphia that always voted Democratic, not a prime spot for intimidating white voters, as conservatives claim. But that hasn't stopped Fox News from reporting on this case no less than 100 times since June. Well, today we want to take a look at Attorney General Eric Holder's Justice Department, which is also taking on Arizona's immigration law, Guantanamo Bay, terror trials, the BP blowout. But let's start with the new Black Panther case with Jonathan Turley. He's constitutional law professor at George Washington University. And Jonathan, Thernstrom, the member of the Civil Rights Commission, also said she wasn't moved by claims made by Republican activist and Bush Justice Department lawyer Christian Adams that the Eric Holder Department of Justice was racially motivated in narrowing this case. But conservatives have seized on it, and you wrote in 2009 that they would. So your take on this whole case, first of all.
Well, you know, it's one of these situations where a small issue can become magnified in the prism of our current toxic politics. And this was, in fact, a relatively small case. Now, I should say that I actually believe that there was good reason for some of the attorneys in the Department of Justice to object to the case being downgraded.
Right.
In my view, looking at those films, this did seem to me clear voter intimidation.
And, these were films of these new Black Panthers standing at an entranceway to a voting place.
Yeah, I think it's a bad precedent for the DOJ to walk away from the case because it would indicate that it's a relatively small matter to have people standing in front of a voting place with a baton, which I think is a rather solid case for voter intimidation. But that means that someone, in my view, made probably the wrong decision. What has not been established is the more inflammatory notion that whites simply have no protection in the Holder Justice Department and that they are racially motivated. I don't believe that's true, and I don't think the record has shown that. But once again, there's this detachment that occurs. It's quite frustrating for many of us who deal with legal matters in the public domain, because there are legitimate issues here. I mean, the Black Panther issue is a legitimate one, and if people actually sort of ratcheted down the rhetoric, there would be a good faith policy question there, but that was lost months ago.
Whether white supremacists or Minutemen or anybody can stand at a certain place in a polling place, and you were looking for that, right? Well, we wonder if you feel that Eric Holder maybe set himself up for this criticism. He is, of course, the first African-American attorney general serving under the first Black president. But in February of 2009, he gave, this is a portion of a speech he gave in honor of Black History Month. Let's listen.
To get to the heart of this country, one must examine its racial soul. Though this nation has proudly thought of itself as an ethnic melting pot, In things racial, we have always been, and we, I believe, continue to be, in too many ways, essentially a nation of cowards.
So Jonathan Turley, did Eric Holder set himself up to be viewed through a prism of race, which he is being viewed through, for instance, with Arizona's new immigration law, which is set to take effect this Thursday?
Well, you know, it's funny that I don't know if he really set himself up. I think that any attorney general for the Obama administration would likely have taken the same steps. But, you know, the Arizona law is another good example of how politics drives the legal debate. I mean, the Arizona law actually has very strong arguments on both sides. I mean, putting aside all the heated rhetoric, the federal government clearly has a case, in my view. It's the case that they're actually not making. That is, I think actually the Arizona law is a serious problem with the reasonable suspicion provision. That doesn't happen to be the thing that the feds are challenging the most. They're trying to get rid of this through what's called federal preemption. Arizona actually has a legitimate argument against federal preemption.
And explain federal preemption.
Well, federal preemption is when the Department of Justice is here, comes in and says, we occupy this field. There's no room for states to have concurrent jurisdiction or to enforce these laws. The Supreme Court actually has rejected that view previously. And while it's not binding necessarily in this case, Arizona has a legitimate argument that all they're doing is carrying out federal law. They're not adding anything. They're actually just enforcing. Well, that's a legitimate debate we can have, but once again, it is entirely lost by the hyper-rhetoric on both sides.
Well, and just remind us, before we take a break here, what exactly is the Department of Justice supposed to do? Yes, uphold the law, but is it also supposed to enact some sort of political policy of the president?
That's right. I mean, the irony here is that politics is actually making it very difficult in a lot of ways. The Department of Justice, in their brief, said, and they were very careful here, where they said, we don't just deport people. In fact, sometimes we decide not to deport people here illegally. Those are all complicated policy questions. But the problem is that there's always been a policy of enforcement against people here illegally. That is, the rhetoric that preceded the Arizona law, you've had both Obama and Bush saying, you know, we will be enforcing these laws. We want to enforce these laws. And so it puts the Obama administration in a really horrible position because they're essentially saying, you're conflicting with federal law by enforcing it.
That's law professor Jonathan Turley. We're taking a look. Actually, I'm going to give a report card to the Justice Department of Eric Holder, who's been attacked from the right for taking on Arizona's immigration law, for instance, but also attacked from the left for what the left sees as his Justice Department being too light on the Bush administration officials. And we'll take a look at that when we come back. Also, later in the program, don't forget, we're going to take a close look at John Ford's classic, The Searchers. You don't want to miss that. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about Eric Holder's Department of Justice with Jonathan Turley, constitutional law professor at George Washington University. And Jonathan, we were just talking about how justice departments are supposed to enact the law, but it's also presumed that it will be the law as seen through the eyes of the sitting president. And Dahlia Lithwick writes in Slate.com that Eric Holder inherited a Justice Department that was confused about where that law began and politics ended. There were, you know, law student interns who were hired based on their loyalty to the GOP, the secret memos authorizing the use of torture. But now the Obama administration is taking heat for not pursuing a possible wrongdoing in that Bush administration. Let's start with the U.S. attorney scandal, the accusation being Justice Department fired them because they weren't loyal to the GOP. You had a 2-year internal investigation by the Justice Department, which closed last week. No criminal charges. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that in terms of the U.S. attorney scandal, this is part of the overall objection that the Holder Justice Department is avoiding any cases that could have political consequences, any serious political consequences. for the administration. I have to say the one exception to that would be the immigration thing, where they seem to be actually taking the position that would have the greatest impact. So I think that goes on the ledger on the other side. The U.S. Attorney's Office, however, I feel the criticism of the Holder administration is a bit misplaced in that it was always a difficult case. I mean, this was a case involving people who clearly should not have been appointed. It is, without question, the lowest point in the Justice Administration. George Bush virtually destroyed the credibility with Al Gore and John Ashcroft. Destroyed the credibility of the Justice Department. They brought in people who were not just political hacks, but unqualified political hacks, which is even worse.
But
what happened with the U.S. Attorney's Office is that there really was a lot there, but it was mainly a policy issue because this was an area that was heavily imbued with discretionary decisions. There were some questions of false testimony that I think could have been prosecuted. But I got to tell you, I think most Justice Departments have been very conservative in taking those types of cases.
Well, then there's torture. Both Eric Holder and President Obama have both basically said they're going to let sleeping dogs lie, refusing to prosecute anyone involved in the authorization of torture. The warrantless wiretapping program under Bush, Holder testified the program was unwise, but he refused to say it was illegal. You had a great line about that. You said you were going to, if you were representing a bank robber, you were going to say that the robbery was unwise.
Yeah. Well, you know, starting with the torture issue, on that I believe that there is no high ground at all. I believe that the Holder Justice Department and the Obama administration as a whole has rightfully been condemned internationally. Their position, in my view, is not just opposed to the law, it's immoral. I mean, the United States has a treaty obligation to investigate torture, and it is a decision that Holder and Obama made out of purely political calculus. That is, they would not allow even an investigation because they knew all too well that waterboarding has long been defined as torture, that waterboarding clearly occurred here, and that under the treaties we're supposed to prosecute them. They knew that if they allowed even a serious investigation, it would go directly and rather quickly to George Bush and Dick Cheney. And politically, they did not want to deal with that. Well, that's a horrible thing.
Well,
when people make excuses about it, but what they are doing is covering up a war crime.
Well, and then we mentioned warrantless wiretapping. We just want to, you know, in full disclosure, mention that you're representing a Muslim cleric in Virginia who may have been wiretapped without a warrant. But I just in the time that we have here, I just want to get your sense of a report card for Eric Holder. He's being viewed, you know, through different political prisms, but take it as a law professor.
Well, I would give him, in terms of rehabilitating the ranks of the Justice Department, bringing back professionalism, I would give him a B+, A-. I think that he's done a terrific job in trying to bring professionalism back to the department. In terms of his decisions as an attorney general, I would have to give him a D, and I'd be tempted to give him an F just based on torture. But in his confirmation hearings, he promised that despite his controversy with pardons during the Clinton administration, where he was seen as acting in a very political and raw fashion, that he would not view issues from a political spectrum.
And this, we should say, was when he pardoned Mark Rich.
Right. And the fact is, he has. I mean, I don't think there is any way you can look at his record and not view Holder as just as political in many respects as his predecessors. And we need to stop making excuses for that. That is, the Democrats, particularly in liberals, need to be consistent. We opposed Gonzalez and others for being these political personalities. He is very, very political as an attorney general, and I think that his legacy will show that. On all the tough issues, the ones where you establish your legacy, either as a leader or as a political appointee purely, he failed on torture, electronic surveillance, the dismissing of citizen suits against telecom communications companies.
Let's throw another one in just to get your response to Gitmo and closing, not only closing Guantanamo Bay, but the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed It was set for Manhattan, and when there was an uproar, which many say was ginned up by Liz Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, and an activist organization, it was moved. Is that,
that was
is that
appalling. I mean, that's one of the most appalling things I've seen in my career, is an attorney general. And first of all, he didn't exactly start out on high ground. He went halfway up the mountain. He actually sent a whole bunch of people into military tribunals and then sent others to a real trial. And then he gave up whatever ground he had by immediately knuckling under to what was the most manufactured political objections. And it just shows that he will not have a legacy to be proud of, and he has not distinguished himself on those political questions from his predecessors.
Well, he's not finished yet. That's Jonathan Turley, constitutional law professor at George Washington University. Not even a midterm grading of Eric Holder, but a look at the Eric Holder Justice Department. Jonathan, thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
Back after the news, here and now. The U.S. Defense Department is spending $9 billion on Iraqi oil, and people want to know how. The U.S. Special Investigator for Iraq Reconstruction reports today that the Pentagon's record-keeping is so lax, it's unclear how most of that money was spent. Remember, Iraq is a country where electricity and water are still scarce, politicians unable to form a new government, and almost daily bombings rock local neighborhoods. But Baghdad was also a neighborhood that was just too quiet for Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Cheryl McCauley. She came across the country's national military band while serving there. It's a ragtag group missing instruments and musicians. When Cheryl McCauley returned home to New Market, Alabama, she decided to help the band rebuild. She joins us now. And Cheryl, tell us about the first time you came across the band.
Well, I was just so overjoyed to hear live music. I was in a combat zone, and so were they. And it was just wonderful to hear band members doing their job, playing their national anthem, and providing the music for this particular ceremony of people who were going to teach in the new Iraqi War College.
But then you met the band members afterwards and discovered that this wasn't the band it once was.
They are in downtown Baghdad in the international zone. Their rehearsal hall is at the Iraqi Tomb of the Unknown.
So they're right in the thick of it.
They're right in the thick of it. And they said, our instruments are in bad shape. Do you know of an American band in Baghdad? And I said yes, and meetings began where the Iraqis have gone to the American location and vice versa, and they're beginning to develop that relationship.
What did you learn about what this band needed?
Well, I tried to find out what instruments do they need to be mission capable. I requested a seating diagram, and we have plugged in the instruments to one-for-one replace the instruments on their seating diagram, on their wish list.
Well, it's a big list. I mean, they you know, because of the chaos of war and because people of musicians dying, they still need a piccolo, 7 clarinets, a bassoon, 2 tenor saxophones, 2 French horns, 5 trumpets, a trombone. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Well, we understand that when you got back to Alabama, you decided to go through your church, the New Market Methodist Church, so that donors can have a tax deduction for their gift in the church. You know, churches are usually pretty good at getting up and running at this kind of thing.
Right.
So how's it going?
It's going well. The outpouring has been wonderful, very positive. The whole time I was deployed, Robin, people asked, what can we do to help? What can we do to help? Well, here's a chance for people to do something to help the Iraqis directly and in a way that will make a difference. These are proud military members who love to play music. And what better way than to make it possible for them to do their jobs better because their instruments are old, their instruments haven't been able to be replaced. This is a chance to make a difference for them.
Just a devil's advocate question. You know, a band, some people might say, what they need are books in schools or money to rebuild the cities or help staff the police force. What is the importance of the band for you?
Oh, the band is so key, Robin, and it's not going to be on anybody's high priority list to address. What I love about this is musicians helping musicians. This is Americans helping Iraqis. This is not a religious program. This is not a military program. This is not a State Department program. I love this because it's people helping people. It makes a difference because we're going to take care of this band first, and any excess instruments we have, Robin, will go to the Iraqi School of Music. And again, that all helps further their programs down the road.
And you have a music background yourself, so tell us more about what you think music does for a country, even as we're cutting music and the arts out of schools here in the U.S., but what do you think it could do for Iraqis?
When you hear the Iraqi band play their own national anthem, It's chilling. And, you know, 30 June last year, when coalition forces were pulling back, the Iraqis stepping up to the plate, the Iraqis taking the reins, I had the good fortune to be able to see the staging of the national parade, and the pride in the Iraqis was just something I will never forget.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Cheryl McCauley speaking to us from New Market, Alabama. She served in Iraq and is now trying to collect instruments for the Iraqi Ceremonial Band. Cheryl, Lieutenant Colonel, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, this is a recording of the Iraqi national anthem as played by the American Navy Band. If you want to help the Iraqi band get back to this level, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Back in 30 seconds with true stories from letter carriers, Here and Now. So, who delivered your mail today? If you're in Fairbanks, Alaska, maybe it was Gary Dupuy, who fights off frostbite on days when tires freeze to the ground. If you're in Minneapolis, Minnesota, maybe it was Paul Tanick, who one day was bitten twice by the same dog. Or if you're in Amesbury, Massachusetts, maybe you know Betsy Wolf. She's the first woman to use the ladies' room at the post office there because there were so few female carriers for so long. Letter carriers, they smell gas leaks, they find lost pets, lost kids. Their stories are now featured in the new book, Carried Away, True Stories from Letter Carriers Across America, a book to celebrate letter carriers and our customers. It's compiled by Kate Drury, a longtime mail carrier in Amesbury, Massachusetts. Kate, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be here.
And Lois McNulty, who was a carrier briefly. She's a retired elementary school teacher. Hello again, Lois.
Hello, Robin.
Letter carriers are sort of the front line in home defense. They notice when the mail's piling up of an elderly person's home and
definitely
someone's not there. I mean, you know, stories of really heroics.
It can be anything from carriers finding people who have fallen, seeing a building on fire and rescuing people. There are countless stories like that.
Right. The carrier that sees a woman who she ran out to retrieve her blowing away garbage can, which smashed her against the garage door and nobody
right.
saw but the carrier.
But the
exactly.
carrier.
Yeah.
And that's what we wanted to celebrate, that the carrier goes to every kind of neighborhood in the whole country. Who else is in the neighborhoods 6 days a week, becoming part of the fabric of the neighborhood?
Well, and we also learn a lot about the profession. For instance, I was calling you mail carriers. Tell us some of the terminology. It's not mail carrier, it's letter carrier.
We're known as letter carriers, correct. And then there's the other craft, which would be clerks who work inside. That you might see them at the window. Then there's mail handlers who work in the plants, pushing and loading the mail. There are drivers.
And who are postal workers?
Postal workers
everybody.
Could be the big umbrella.
Everybody.
Right.
Postal workers are who will eventually benefit from the sale of this book, we hope.
Tell us about this, because you know proceeds are going to benefit the Postal Employee Relief Fund. What is that?
Right. It's a fund set up so that any postal worker, whether you be a postmaster or a clerk or a carrier, if you would experience a natural disaster such as tornadoes, floods, fires, Katrina was huge, and if you have financial damage to your house or you've lost your home, you can apply to the Postal Employee Relief Fund, and they've given away millions of dollars. So all the books that we sell, 100% of the proceeds go to the Postal Employee Relief Fund.
Well, good for you, because I'm imagining, you know, you yourself could have used this, you know, a retired teacher and a postal worker.
It's a labor of
love. It is a labor
of
love.
That's really what keeps us going. And it wasn't just letter carriers who sent us stories. It became some customers as well.
Because their letter carriers mean something to them.
Yes.
There's a lot of funny stuff in here. Susan DeLude of Lakewood, California, writes about a little girl who was playing with her grandma and stopped in her tracks when she saw Susan come delivering the mail and said, "Look, it's a male mommy."
Right.
Or about the little kid who saw a carrier coming along with a priority package.
Right.
And it was, you know, big square-shaped package. He looked up and he said, "Pizza!"
The mailman delivers pizza, too.
Yeah.
There are pictures of mailboxes from across the country. Here's one in Andes, New York, that's in the shape of a rooster. Another from Rye Beach, New Hampshire, shaped like an old car. Cartoons. I love the one.
Is that the one at the beach?
Yeah.
My sister loved that one, too.
Yeah. There's a man standing on the beach talking to a woman. He says, "Well, yes, I'm a letter carrier. How did you know?" And he is tanned up to just above his elbows and up to his knees.
Right.
And obviously, you know, know, he wears the letter carrier.
The shorts and the socks.
Right. But Lois, there are also some, I think I heard you say, that brought you to tears.
There was one carrier who,
speaking
the polio
of,
story.
Yes.
The,
yeah. Oh,
I love that story.
That was actually sent in by a customer who wrote about the carrier, yeah, saying that when he was delivering mail, two of the boys in the family had polio. One was really in the hospital often.
And this was years ago when they,
yes,
first contracted it.
Very long time ago. And then when the carrier got switched to a different route, he came back many years later to the same neighborhood and inquired about this family.
The little boy.
How is
who
he
had
now?
Polio.
How's little Marky? Yeah. Little Marky was like 21 years old and doing so well. And the carrier was so impressed that he actually was invited to his wedding.
Oh.
So there's a real relationship, as Lois said.
And what was the name of that customer that said that?
Mark Higgins Ho from San Diego.
Well, and that reminds me of John Camerano from Milford, Connecticut, who had a customer who'd wait every day for a letter from her son in the military.
Right.
And he'd ring the bell to let her know he had one instead,
right,
of just putting the mail,
exactly,
in the box.
Exactly. And there was another story in there from another carrier who had a letter addressed to someone he had never heard of, and it was scrawled on the front. I don't know if he still lives here, but I'm trying to find my old Army buddy. So the carrier went to the phone book, and he found the Army buddy. You do feel a personal connection with your customers.
Kate, people are going to write about you someday being this kind of carrier. She goes and visits her patrons in the nursing homes on her days off. Every day off, she's visiting seniors.
Well, I do. I have a lot of senior citizens on my route, and you do generally care about them, especially the ones that don't have families to visit. When they end up leaving my route and going to a nursing home, I often try to visit them to establish a little connection.
Well, and Lois, I understand you learned early on of the, you know, the deep
craft,
relationship and the craft through your dad. He was a carrier?
He was. The thing that I remember about my dad doing the job was that he always made his customers laugh. He always had a little joke for them.
And he was in Pompano Beach, Florida.
He was in Pompano Beach, Florida, right. And what inspired me about my dad was that he once walked from South Florida to Washington, D.C., along Route 1. It was a trip of over 1,000 miles, which he made on his own, wearing regular letter carrier shoes and carrying the same weight that he would have in his mailbag, just to prove that he was fit enough to carry the U.S. mail. Because when he got old, they wanted him to take a disability retirement, and he refused. He wanted to carry the mail.
What was his name?
His name was John McNulty.
For those who remember him from Pompano Beach.
Yes.
Well, we can't let you go without asking about the dogs. Just give us your favorite dog stories.
I think one of mine is where the carrier sees this German shepherd break free and start running toward him. And the carrier is walking backwards and steps up against the screen and he can't go anymore. And the dog leaps on him and proceeds to look him in the face.
I like your dog story. Kate has one about they told her, this is how you deal with a dog. You firmly say, go home. So the first time a dog looked like he was attacking, Kate stood there, stood her ground, and said, go home. But the dog kept coming. Finally, after a few minutes, Kate heard a voice behind her, and it was the owner of the house saying, he lives here.
Is it? He's trying to go home.
Right.
Lois McNulty and Kate Drury, authors of Carried Away, True Stories from Letter Carriers Across America, a book to celebrate letter carriers and our customers. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
What makes a man to wonder? What makes a man to roar?
Today, directors like Scorsese and Coppola say it's their favorite movie. The American Film Institute calls it the best Western of all time. It's John Ford's 1956 film, The Searchers, which begins with this song, written by Stan Jones and performed by the Sons of the Pioneers.
Ride away. Ride away.
But critics like Roger Ebert found the film flawed. Pauline Kael said it was corny. Slate calls it the worst best movie ever. So what is it about The Searchers? John Wayne stars as Civil War veteran Ethan Edwards, welcomed home by his brother's family in Texas. They're soon brutally attacked by Comanche Indians, who kidnap Ethan's niece Debbie and her older sister. So Ethan goes on a 7-year search for the girls, accompanied by their adopted brother, Matthew.
Do you think maybe there's a chance we still might find her?
Injun will chase a thing till he thinks he's chased it enough. Then he quits. Same way when he runs. Seems like he never learns there's such a thing as a critter will just keep coming on. So we'll find him in the end, I promise you. We'll find him.
Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr joins us. Ty, nice to see you as always.
Thank you.
Where do you stand on the film?
I think it's a terrific film. I think it's actually a brave, unusual film. Yes, I think there are aspects of it that are corny, that are of the time that it was made. I don't think it's a perfect film, but it is certainly, I think, one of John Ford's most self-aware films, and it also has, far and away, the most thoughtful and best acting performance that John Wayne ever did.
And we're reminded he didn't win a thing for this.
No.
And in the 70s, you know, a few decades later, he would be sort of caricatured as the, even started talking like him, you know, the guy who supported the war in Vietnam and a cowboy and the guy the world was passing by. But you say what about this performance?
Well, you know, one thing with John Wayne is he got caught up in the country's culture wars and it becomes difficult to see him as an actor. But that's what he was. He wasn't, you know, a method actor, but he was a very intuitive and thoughtful. And in this one, he really did sort of go method. He stayed Ethan between takes. He was a hard, bitter man, and that's the point of the film.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of that. The film starts with John Wayne's character's homecoming. He's fought in the Civil War on the Confederate side, and we immediately pick up something between him and his brother's wife, some love, perhaps. Also, his hatred for Indians. Here's a scene where we first see his nephew Matthew, now quite grown up, played by Jeffrey Hunter. He is part Indian. Let's listen.
Well, I could mistake you for a half-breed.
Not quite. I'm 8th Cherokee. The rest is Welsh and English. At least that's what they tell me.
Grown some.
It was Ethan found you, squalling under a sage clump after your folks had been massacred.
It just happened to be me. No need to make more of it.
He is a bitter racist.
He's a racist.
And in fact, the mistake some people make when they come to this film cold is that they think the film is racist. It is about racism.
Well, and we see where some of his emotions come from. This family that he's just been reunited with is pretty much wiped out by Indians. He's the one that discovers them. I mean, that's the other thing about his character. He may come off as a caricature of the man, but he does do the hard stuff.
Well, in fact, one of the most striking scenes in The Searchers is after he sets out to find the kidnapped daughters, and he comes back from finding one of their bodies.
I found Lucy back in the canyon. Wrapped her in my coat. Buried her with my own hands. Thought it best to keep it from you.
Oh. Did they? What was she?
What do you want me to do? Draw you a picture? Spell it out? Don't ever ask me. Long as you live, don't ever ask me more.
That's an astounding scene. Yeah. John Wayne loses it. I don't think I've ever seen John Wayne lose it in a movie, and he becomes unglued.
We also realize that as upset as he is, as pained as he is, that this niece of his has been more than likely raped by the Indians. The younger niece, who's still missing, he sets out to find but also kill.
Well, she's been taken in by the Comanches and has become the wife of the chief, which to him is miscegenation.
No matter how much he loved her.
It's not her anymore. And the battle becomes, as expressed by Jeffrey Hunter, as the adopted nephew who wants to save her, the battle becomes between those two points of view of Native Americans and how we deal with them when we're, you know, running them out of their own country.
Well, not just, I mean, you could look at it through today's lens. It's about mixed race.
Absolutely. I mean, there's one of the most unusual things about this movie is that it addresses in very complicated terms, but not in words, complex notions about race, about sex, about intermarriage, about civilization. There's so much going on in this film, but it is so simply directed. And, you know, we listen to these sound clips, and the sound clips almost don't do the film justice because so much is done silently. You have to remember, Ford started in the silent cinema, and so much of this film is told just with oblique images. We find out that John Wayne's character is in love with his sister-in-law only through how they look at each other.
Which led me to ask, has anyone ever speculated that this missing child is his?
Yes, in fact, that has popped up in some critical commentary that possibly both of his brother's children are his.
And so he's considering killing.
He's considering killing his own child, but then in his fevered mind, it's not his child anymore. It's one of them.
Yeah. Well, Tiber, you know, I found myself watching the film and agreeing with some of the critics who say it's a little mannered, you know, all the pioneer people, gol gee, and, you know, so caricatured. But then, you know, you get to that scene where the family realizes that they are surrounded by Indians. The parents don't tell the children. They don't want them to know. I mean,
it's a horrifying
scene.
It's
horrifying.
The older daughter comes in with a lamp, and the mother rushes over. They're trying to remain calm, but clearly they it's a hopeless scene. They know they're going to die. And she blows the lantern out, and the daughter understands what that means. And she lets out this scream that's one of the most unearthly screams I've ever heard in a classic Hollywood film.
We've seen nothing yet.
No, we haven't seen anything. So much of this film is done by inference.
Yeah. What would you say, you know, overall, is its hold on us?
I do think it has its corny elements. I mean, the Indian chief is played by a white man with blue eyes in makeup. So you look at that, and a modern viewer rejects it.
And we should say John Wayne, as we said, became sort of the symbol of macho support of a war in the 70s. And John Ford made propaganda films for the U.S. government. It was also seen as kind of a macho man's man. So you can look at it that way as well.
But this movie questions macho. It undercuts the attitude that if we just go out there, we can take over America and we'll get to the sea and that'll be great. It shows what kind of man it actually takes to do the conquering, and it's not a pretty picture. And believe me, everybody who made this film, from Frank Nugent, the screenwriter, to John Ford, to John Wayne, to all the cast, was completely aware of what they were saying in this film. It's a very self-aware movie, and its levels of darkness keep taking you by surprise, and the way it also brings you back into the light.
And we're not going to give away that ending.
Okay.
And this film also inspired at least two people who saw it, Buddy Holly and Jerry Allison. The story goes, went to see The Searchers and wrote the song That'll Be the Day based on.
John Wayne has a catchphrase in the film, as he does in many John Ford films. Whenever anybody says, you know, Ethan, we're going to do this or you have to do this, he says, that'll be the day.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye.
Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr helping us take a look at the 1956 John Ford film The Searchers. Ty, thanks as always.
Thanks, Rob.
Because that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirt of loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you know you love me, baby. Still, you tell me maybe that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye.